Humans have been telling stories ever since we began talking. Stories have become a kind of tool, as powerful as an axe or an arrow. In our series, The Human Edge, NPR is looking at the things that helped our species succeed. Today, NPR science correspondent John Hamilton has our latest report on how stories affect what we do with our lives.
Not so long ago, Sean Parker was waiting offstage at a club in Hollywood. He was about to stand in front of hundreds of people and tell a story he'd been working on his entire life.
I was so nervous, I felt like I wanted to throw up.
It was more than stage fright. Sean says what was at stake for him was pretty much everything.
So I'm like, this is it, right? This has been the dream to come out here. And there's actors, and there's writers, and there's directors out here, and the people that are true storytellers, because I'm just some guy coming from Wisconsin.
Menasha, Wisconsin. It's a smallish city on the northern tip of Lake Winnebago. It has lots of paper mills and good sledding in the winter. And that's where Sean's story begins. Sean Parker was born in 1969. He's the youngest of four children. When he got to eighth grade, a teacher had the class write letters to themselves. The topic? How they saw their future lives.
I wrote, well, you know, what do I want from the future? I guess find somebody that I love and work in a mill, get a house, and have some kids.
That was pretty standard for kids growing up in Menasha. And it was pretty much what Sean's father had done. 4 years later, Sean's teacher sent back all the letters. When Sean read his, he realized he'd already started rewriting his future.
I like the idea that I was meant to be something more. I always said that we're kind of the sum total of the decisions we make in life. And I just felt like I could very easily make the decisions that lead me away from that path of being more, whatever it is.
So Sean started planning a life beyond the paper mills, beyond Menasha. Antonio Damasio from the University of Southern California says Sean was doing something we all do. Although we're not aware of it, he says, we think about our own life as if it were a story in the making. That's how our brains are wired.
You're constantly rearranging the narrative of your life. And you're rearranging it, of course, as a function of the experiences that you have had and as what you imagine your experiences in the future ought to be.
Damasio is a behavioral neurologist. He says humans have a unique awareness that their own lives are stories that begin when we're born and end when we die. And because we know we're going to die, we are not satisfied with just surviving day to day. To give our lives meaning, we strive for what Sean calls something more. Damasio says you don't see that in other species.
I have enormous respect for non-human creatures, but I don't think we're going to get them to consider this something more that they can be or that they ought to be. And this is what humans clearly excel at.
It's that drive that pushes humans to do new things, explore distant lands, and build great civilizations. We're drawn to tales of remarkable people, Odysseus, Joan of Arc, Muhammad, Confucius. Sean always admired his father. He was a pragmatist who never gave up. But it was the people Sean saw on screen that would shape his own life story.
I just was always amazed that I could go in to this darkened theater, right? And somebody was able to make me cry, able to make me laugh, or make me able to just have these emotional rides.
One movie in particular inspired Sean, Excalibur. It retells the legend of King Arthur.
Merlin, why have you done this to me?
Because you were born to be king.
What does it mean to be king?
You will be the
land. It just speaks of greater things than ourselves. I remember seeing it and just, it made me want to believe in destiny.
And it made Sean wonder, how could he make something special of his own life? King Arthur was destined to defend his country against the Saxons and search for the Holy Grail. Damasio says something happens to us when we absorb a tale like that.
We begin by being spectators of a story.
Sean sees Excalibur.
And then very rapidly we turn that into our own story.
Sean realized the Holy Grail was probably beyond his reach, and the Saxons weren't invading Menasha. So he focused on the quest for true love. King Arthur had his queen, Guinevere.
I had a couple girlfriends, but yeah, I got bored quickly. Like, it was easy to find fault and be like, is she really my queen?
Then he saw Heidi.
I was in the cafeteria, and I remember looking over, and I saw her walk in, and time kind of slowed.
Destiny. But for a chivalrous young man, there was a problem.
I was kind of stumped by the fact that I was a senior and she was a freshman, and that did not feel right.
So he decided to wait. He'd just be Heidi's friend until she was older. But it was hard. After 18 months, Sean decided he had to declare his love. He made Heidi a video. Picture a good-looking, all-American kid with a mullet, wide lapels, and a long-stemmed robe. He's lip-syncing to a song called Wait. He never showed it to her. Instead, he sent her an old-fashioned love letter. And soon, he got a letter back.
Dear Sean, you are the best friend I have ever had. And she underlined friend in an infinite line that was explicit that I would never cross over.
Sean was crushed. Setbacks aren't unique to humans, but Damasio says our response to them probably is. We see them as changing the plot line of the life story we thought we were writing. And we cope by coming up with a new narrative.
In any moment of the present, we are buffeted between the lived best, about which we cannot do anything, and the future, the what next.
The point is, humans never stop looking ahead to something better. King Arthur deals with his unfaithful queen by focusing on the Holy Grail. Sean rebounds from Heidi by imagining an entirely different future for himself. He's going to make it in the movie business. All through college, he works on that dream. By the time he graduates, he has an entry-level job with Disney, all lined up. And then, on the very day Sean is to leave Menasha, the phone rings. His father takes the call. It's his father's doctor.
The doctor said, you know, it's stage 4 prostate cancer. You know, you got to come in. So that's kind of where my life went on pause.
Another setback, major. And this one was to last nearly 2 decades. But Sean never gave up on the life story he was determined to write for himself, which is why, many years later, he steps onto a stage in Hollywood.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sean.
Tomorrow, how Sean got through those 2 decades, and how bringing meaning to our own stories helps us cope with adversity and even death. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And those reports are being told with the help of producer Rebecca Davis.
Adventure, theft, big money, ancient mysteries, and death. Sounds like the plot of a good beach read, right? But author Craig Child is telling a true life story in his latest book, Finders Keepers, a tale of archaeological plunder and obsession. It's an illuminating look at the world of relic hunters and some say grave robbers who fuel a multi-million dollar trade in antiquities. Craig Childs joins me now. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Audie.
I have to say, I love this book. I mean, I was completely riveted.
And
part of it is because you really shake up the whole idea of, like, what's legal, you know, what is an artifact, what is archaeology, and what is grave robbing.
Yeah, it is. It's a tricky business. Just walking out in places where there's archaeology on the ground is tricky because when you find something, when you lean over and pick up an arrowhead or a potsherd, or you see the rim of a ancient bowl sticking out of the ground, you kind of have to decide, what are you going to do next? And what do other people do next once they find those things?
What is legal? What's a legal artifact? Give us an example of one that is and one that isn't.
Just recently, I was up in the Bering Sea, an island just off the coast of Siberia, St. Lawrence Island, where the island is natively owned, and Yupik Eskimos living there are going out and digging up sites and selling artifacts from their sites. And these artifacts are legal because they come from a privately owned island.
But at the same time, you're saying if someone else was there plucking it, you might look at it a completely different way.
Yeah, and you might not get off that island if you were trying to take artifacts from there.
So, Craig Childs, there was a lot of really fascinating information in your book about how people actually go about taking artifacts and then even smuggling artifacts. I mean, can you talk a little bit about how people get this stuff out of the ground and onto the black market?
Well, around where I live, especially over in Utah and the Four Corners area, the artifacts are often so close to the surface that people helicopter in, and there have been cases where the helicopter has lowered its tail rotor toward the ground and actually blown off the surface, where they can actually see objects starting to appear.
Oh, my gosh.
And so people are coming in by helicopter, by airplane. I was out there getting buzzed once by an airplane coming down on the Navajo reservation that was going over and over a site that was right behind me that I had just found for the first time, a large buried ceremonial chamber. And as they were flying over, I was figuring, you know, I bet they're selling this site. I bet there's somebody in the airplane going, yeah, that looks good. I think we can get $10,000 out of that.
So how do legal sales affect the black market?
Well, the more artifacts that are sold, the more artifacts are needed. And artifacts then get laundered. They lose their context until they can join a collection and appear to be legal. So in many ways, there's no such thing as a black market, because eventually these artifacts do rise up, and even ones that are illicitly acquired, they look like they're legal. They look like they're completely legit.
So then give us an example of an artifact that's, I guess, maybe made it to a museum where that journey might have been a little bit dubious.
Well, if you follow the Euphronius vase that went to the Met.
And what did this look like?
A beautiful, large ceramic, almost like a little bathtub that you would mix water and wine in. You'd go into the Met, and there it was in its own display case, just beautiful paintings of warriors and gods all around it. Just one of the finest Greek vessels ever found. And, you know, it was sold with paperwork that said, you know, this thing is legal. But a lot of people questioned it. And after a while, it was finally figured out through raids and photographs and notebooks that it was indeed smuggled.
What is the difference between archaeology and grave robbing?
Well, archaeology as a science is holding on to the information. So you're digging up an object and you have the context around it. You know, did this pot come from a kitchen site, a living room, a burial? And you can date objects around it, and you keep this context.
And so there's that balance between what we want, the general public, in terms of learning about history, our own or of other cultures, and I guess disturbing these worlds that are out there.
Oh, yeah. It's a tough balance, because I've worked on quite a few archaeological excavations where you're down in a trench digging with a trowel and wondering, what on earth am I doing? Digging through some dead person's belongings. It definitely is eerie, and I know many archaeologists who feel the same way. Even though a lot of information comes out and we know so much more about the past, there's still this sense of violation that you're digging into somebody else's life.
Your book talks a lot about figures who, once they're arrested or indicted on related to wrongdoing in this world, commit suicide, or like these fights and feuds between folks in this industry. And it kind of makes you think of pirates or something. I mean, there is this element of, I guess, danger, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, in a strange way, it's a very violently charged atmosphere where, you know, during the writing of this book, several people that I was following died by suicide, or one woman died in her jail cell. Others went to prison. It's got a certain kind of edge to it that I kind of trace back to the emotional edge. We there is such an attachment to what is the right and wrong thing to do with these objects, and what is legal, what is illegal, and it really rises to the surface where I know some archaeologists who want pot hunters dead, and I know pot hunters who want archaeologists dead. There are some bad rivalries going on here.
What does this mean for how you think about what is right when it comes to antiquities?
Well, seeing things on the ground, seeing things where they are, I've come to believe that artifacts need to stay in their place. And that's after having gone through museum collections and seeing just the vast amounts of material that we've gathered already, and going through private collections and just realizing how much we have swept up from the ground. And when I find something that's on the ground, even if it's a tiny thing, even if it's a broken arrowhead, it is so much more powerful there than it is on a shelf or in a display case. And you know, I'm not saying we need to get rid of all the artifacts we've gathered. I'm just looking at it going, we don't need to take everything. We can leave some stuff out there, and there's not that much left. I walk thousands and thousands of miles across deserts and mountains, and I know, I've seen the holes, I've seen where diggers have been, and I know that there's a lot missing, and I know these last pieces that are remaining are rare, and I don't want them moving.
Author Craig Childs, his new book is Finders Keepers, A Tale of Archaeological Plunder and Obsession. Craig Childs, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Maudie.
We're going to spend some minutes with the economy now. Financial markets have been jumpy all year, and especially so in the last few weeks because of all the gloomy news about the economy. To find out what's going on, we've asked David Wessel to join us, as he often does. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and just back from vacation, David.
That's right.
I hear. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So let's begin with the markets. What have the various markets been doing, and what do they tell us about where the economy is headed?
Well, despite a surge on Friday following Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's vow to rescue the U.S. economy if it needs help, the stock market has been kind of lousy lately. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 4% this year. The Standard & Poor's 500 Index down about 7%. All that while the economy has been growing a bit and profits have been very strong. We see global investors fleeing to the safety of U.S. Treasury debt, and we've seen big swings in the value of various currencies, the euro, the dollar, and the yen. I think if you add it all up, the markets are showing understandable signs of worry that the U.S. economic recovery is running out of steam prematurely, and that with lots of unemployment and lots of unused factories and lots of empty office buildings, and that the government can't or politically won't do enough to get it going again at a more reasonable rate.
Has this been a change in mood? It feels that way.
Oh, I think so. Since the spring, the outlook has really darkened. Several reasons for that. One is we keep getting new data on the economy about housing, business capital spending plans, etc., and most of it's been negative. Just on Friday, the government said, well, the economy didn't grow at a 2.4% annual rate in the second quarter. It grew only 1.6% when they got all the data in. That's discouraging. And so the optimists on Wall Street are throwing in the towel and saying the second half of the year is going to be disappointing. Businesses are very cautious, particularly about hiring, and that's really important. Intel, which while is doing this buying overseas, said last week it's worried about the demand for personal computers. That hurts the sales of the chips it makes. We'll get more information this week, but there's been signs of worry there. And then finally, there's been this renewed focus on deflation, a decline in prices and wages throughout the economy. That's a big problem. It makes it hard for the Federal Reserve to manage the economy, and it also makes paying back debts, of which we have a lot as Americans, harder. So that deflation fear has come right back to the front stage lately.
You know, a country that's had a lot of experience with deflation, of course, is Japan. And this morning, there was news out of Japan that the government was taking some slightly bolder steps to try and boost the economy there.
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of interesting. Japan's been completely out of the headlines for some time, overshadowed by China, the U.S., and Europe. But they've had a weak economy. They've been, as you point out, battling mild deflation for years now. And things took a turn for the worse there. As the whole global growth outlook sags, their outlook sags. They have fears of renewed deflation there. And their currency has soared for various reasons, and that's endangering their exports, which are important to their growth in Japan. They are a real export powerhouse, and all this happens at a time of political turmoil. So today, the Bank of Japan said it's going to pump more credit into the economy, 10 trillion yen more credit, in an attempt to get things going again and to prevent the yen from rising. It met with a great deal of not enough from the markets right off, and the government there, which is huge debt already, is thinking of new fiscal stimulus to try and get things going again.
Now, David, is there any good news in the economy?
That's
anywhere
a good question.
In the world?
Yeah, actually, there is. Let me give you three examples. One is Europe is doing better than expected, especially Germany. The Congressional Budget Office told us last week that the much-criticized TARP program, the Troubled Asset Relief Program that bailed out the banks, is going to cost us over its lifetime $66 billion. That's a lot, but it's a lot less than the $350 billion it said when the program started a few years ago. And then, of course, there's always somebody who makes money in adversity. Hormel Foods, the century-old company that makes Spam, which I get what people turn to when times are tough. Well, their stock is up 12% this year. It's had hit an all-time high because at times of crisis, I guess people turn to cheap staples and they make them.
Boy, don't you wish you had been buying Spam stock 2 years ago?
As long as I don't have to buy the Spam, yes.
David, thanks very much for joining us again.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal.
Classes begin today at Northern Arizona University, and students may feel a little more pressure to roll out of bed and make it to that 8 o'clock lecture because the school is installing electronic scanners outside some large lecture halls. The scanners will track attendance. Our own tracking system marks down Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker as present for this report.
Brandon Cruikshank has taught Chemistry 101 in this cavernous classroom at NAU for 15 years.
When I started here, I was of the mindset that this is college. Students should decide for themselves whether they want to show up or not. This is no longer high school.
But over the years, he's seen that attending class does matter. So now he factors class participation into his students' grades, most of whom are freshmen.
We do have to say to a lot of those students that it really is important that you do show up to class. You are not going to do well if you're not there.
Research suggests that missing even one class can result in a lower GPA for first-year students. And a freshman's grades in particular are really important, says Karen Pugliese. She's NAU's vice provost for academic affairs.
The stronger a student's grade performance in the first year, the far more likely they are to persist at Northern Arizona University and graduate.
Universities across the country are struggling to boost lagging graduation rates. At NAU, only about 30% of incoming freshmen will earn a degree in 4 years. About 3 in every 10 students drop out after the first year. And if something as simple as going to class could help turn that around, Pugliese thinks it's appropriate to make it a priority.
There's a lot of compelling things out there. There's a lot of competing choices that a student can make. We ought to, I think, do everything we can to make that choice the most likely.
Which is where NAU's new electronic attendance pilot project comes in. The school received $85,000 in federal stimulus funds to install scanners outside 20 large lecture halls, like Brandon Cruikshank's chemistry classroom, where it's not practical to take roll. When students flash their ID cards near a scanner, a light turns green and they get checked off on an attendance report.
I don't see why we need to be told what to do anymore. And I feel as though it's a move towards that, towards treating us as though we're juveniles.
Junior Rachel Brackett has mobilized student opposition to the project. She's launched a Facebook page, gathered 2,000 signatures, and organized a rally against the plan. She says part of the college experience is learning to make your own decisions and living with the consequences.
I really felt like NAU is not giving students enough initiative. They coddle us, I almost feel like, in a lot of our classes.
She also doesn't like how the school could track where she is in a, quote, Big Brother way. Linda D'Angelo with the Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA shares those concerns.
Rather than focusing on did students go, in other words, did they scan their card, the more important thing to think about is what are they doing in the classroom? Are they actively participating?
Universities also have a strong financial incentive to retain their students. It costs about $400 to recruit a single student to a public school, nearly $2,000 to a private college. Every time a student drops out, that process starts all over again. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Crocker in Flagstaff.